I arrived just over 2 weeks ago, and I'm already feeling a bit dangerously at home in the city and at IMI. It feels like I've been here longer, but I think it's a good thing. In case you're wondering about my strange accent, people have asked, but I grew up in Swaziland, Zambia, and South Africa before going to university in England and marrying a Canadian. So in Canada, they think I'm English. In South Africa, they think I'm Canadian. And in England, people often ask me if I'm from Australia or New Zealand. So put me wherever you want to put me in that framework. So I'm delighted today to share some of my research with you. Much of my work for the past 15 years or so has been on this intersection, this gender, migration, and development intersection, but specifically within the Southern African region, which, as I don't need to tell you, has undergone dramatic socio-political changes over the past 20 years since the end of official apartheid in 1994. So that makes it a particularly interesting place to study, because amongst the things that's changed, obviously, or maybe not obviously, are migration dynamics, particularly regional cross-border migration dynamics. So in my talk, I'll be drawing on that research in Southern Africa to examine a broader set of debates about the relationship between migration and development, and to do so from a particular perspective of gender and gender relations. Again, I certainly don't need to remind anyone in this audience of the multi-stranded and bi-directional connections between migration and development, because IMI researchers have very much led, and I think continue to lead, that body of scholarship and debates in understanding the relationships between migration and development. It is an interesting moment, I guess, in some of those debates, because migration and development 10 years ago, people were talking about this having become a kind of mantra in development discourse, and this kind of positive, optimistic era where migration was going to solve all sorts of development problems. And it's now in a more kind of slightly more pessimistic or skeptical phase, maybe. I don't know how we should think about that. Maybe in terms of pendulum swings, like Hinder Haas has written about, the pendulum seems to be knocked into a wobble from which it may never recover by the kind of securitization of migration discourse. So in earlier thinking on this, and framing even a different version of a similar talk, it was set in terms of that idea of the migration and development mantra, but I no longer think in those terms, so it's more complicated than that. Maybe we can get into some of that in the discussion. But nevertheless, I think whatever state we're in, whether optimistic, pessimistic, skeptical, post-mantra, whatever, most discussions of migration and development, whether they are academic literature or even more so in the kind of policy realm, seem to have something of a blind spot when it comes to gender. They treat it, if at all, in rather limited and particular ways. So I'm hoping to at least contribute some, throw out some ideas about those things, as well as talking specifically about the Southern African case. And I think looking at migration and development through a gender lens isn't just some kind of human rightsy such a key thing, but it can actually add important academic understanding to that migration-development relationship. So in the talk, and after this kind of very brief introduction and some background, I'll again more briefly review some of that literature that critiques kind of dominant constructions or mainstream, whatever you want to call them, of the migration-development relationship, concentrating on critiques that have come from gender and feminist scholars. But the main part of my talk, I hope, will be on the Southern African part, and we can get into just some of those other issues in the Q&A. And please stop me if at any stage you want more explanation or less explanation, tell me to get on with it. And you will see maps like this, this particular one from The Guardian, like where the money goes and what's all excited about the volume of remittances internationally, and this is the kind of new big thing, particularly as a source of development finance. You won't be able to read the countries, I put that just for the, yes, two purposes, just to show there's a lot of money sloshing around, but also that things like The Guardian are interested in and talking about and writing about migration and development, largely in the form of these remittance flows. The graphs at the bottom, the bar charts at the bottom, show the top 10 recipients in sort of absolute whatever dollar values, and on the left, and then on the right, the top 10 recipients in terms of proportion of GDP. And of course, those are different countries. So the top few in terms of volume. Other big countries, or big population countries with large diasporas like India, China, Mexico, and the Philippines. The top four, though, when you look at it in terms of percent of GDP, is a different set of countries, and there's countries like some of the Central Asian countries that emerged in the fallout from the Soviet Union, some of the Pacific Islands, some Caribbean countries, and often near the top is the country of Lesotho in South Africa, which gets, well, depending on exactly what numbers you believe, but at least a quarter of its GDP comes from migrant remittances. And of course, there's much more to thinking about migration and development than remittances, but they are an undeniably important part of the migration-development relationship. And I think it's easy to be critical of the kind of elite discourse around remittances, but it's also important to remember that for many migrants, remittances are exactly why they're migrating, so you can critique the elite discourse, but also, you know, they move so that they can send money home, so remittances for them are a very important part of their migration decision-making, from, you know, whether to migrate at all to where they go and what they do and what they send home. This is just another way of looking at those, you know, same numbers, and I'm not a big quantitative person, and I always have, as soon as I see numbers, I go, yes, but that's probably wrong, because I can think of 15 reasons why the numbers probably aren't accurate. But again, an indicator. So if you look at the top 10 remittance corridors as percentage of Pacific GDP, this is, well, from 2010, so it's probably changed somewhat, but not relatively. The South Africa Lesotho one is always up there. So it's small in absolute terms, but I think it's an interesting case study. I mean, Lesotho always shows up, but there are a lot of other countries in the Southern African region where, although not as high in terms of percentage of GDP, migrant remittances are certainly significant. It's just that the GDP is, the, you know, the denominator is bigger, so they don't show up as big a percent. There's more other stuff going on. But, you know, Swaziland, Mozambique, Zimbabwe in particular, in recent years, there were very large both numbers, well, large volumes of remittances going back to those countries as well. So this is not just about Lesotho. And, of course, some of those groups, Zimbabweans too, you know, Zimbabweans in the UK, as well as in South Africa. So I don't want us to think of this as some kind of exceptional region, or these people as people only operating within that region. It's part of a much bigger story. Again, I don't want to dwell on this too much, other than situate the rest of what I'm going to say within it, and to link it to what I said at the beginning. You know, the mantra thing, I think we are in the post-mantra of migration and development era. Alan Gammon, who has strong associations with IMI and other Oxford migration bodies, Compass, and so on, has written a very helpful review recently, published last year in Progress in Human Geography, pointing to this, well, kind of new pessimism or skepticism around migration and development. And earlier on, a few years ago, some people from IMI were involved in it, but there was a conference in Copenhagen on the migration development mantra, retained, rejected, or reinvented, in which there was a range of quite fundamental critiques of that migration and development linkage in the way it was over-celebrated, to some more kind of cautionary notes about how maybe we could kind of rethink that kind of mantra discourse. So there's a lot out there, and has been for a few years now, saying, you know, hang on, there's more to this, we need to look at it more closely. A lot of that literature is kind of yes, but literature, it might work here, but it doesn't work there, and if you look at, you know, how it's distributed within places, etc. So there's a kind of geography to that literature as well. But even the more critical literature from my reading, and again, I won't claim to have done a systematic survey or review of it, although that's something I'm hoping to do, tends to have ignored the gender part. I mean, it's kind of puzzled to me, but maybe I just haven't found it, maybe it's out there and I'm just not seeing it or reading it. But even the more sort of recent critical literature, I think, ignores gender. There is, though, this parallel literature, and I mean parallel as in there's the kind of migration and development literature, including the critical stuff, and then there's the gender and migration literature and gender and development literature over here. I'm not a whole lot of between them, but I think those conversations show interesting things, or potentially show interesting things. So gender and development scholars, or gender and migration scholars, have been critiquing the migration and development kind of celebratory mantra thing for a long time. They've been suspicious from the start, really, largely on the grounds of, but hang on, what about, you know, the gender dynamics of all this? And here I just have time to give a, you know, brief kind of summary bullet point thing on some of the main areas within that literature. So people looking at gendered migrant labor and livelihoods. So, you know, the Philippines is often held up as a country in which, you know, its people are its biggest export, etc., in which remittances are really crucial to the national economy, and indeed they are, all that is true. But the experiences of a Filipina nanny going to Canada and a Filipino person going and becoming a seafarer are very different. And the implications of those migrations for their families are very different, and their, you know, everyday lives in those gendered migrant streams are very different, and the precise nature of their remittance behavior is different, and the development impact of those migrations is different. So there's literature on that. And even larger and, I guess, longer-standing literature on the role of migration in social reproduction, the very gendered flows in that kind of migration, and again the gendered impacts in source and destination countries. So work on things like the global care chain by Eleanor Kaufman and others. Feminist researchers being feminist researchers. There's a lot of work on kind of migrant subjectivities and sort of gendered lived experiences of migration, you know, within either within that migration and development mode or other types of migration. A woman called Rachel Silvey, whose work you may have read, does really excellent stuff on that. There have been some quite fundamental scholars who've worked on both development and migration and piecing those things together. But feminist critiques of understandings of development itself. So, Parvati Raghuram, who uses looking at gender and migration as a way to then look at development, and she has a very good paper, which migration, what development, or whose migration, what development, that tries to kind of unpack some of that stuff. Feminist scholars or gender scholars have critiqued the kind of household strategy and new economics of labor migration approaches to understanding migration itself, but also migration development linkages. There's a growing body of work on sort of the exploitation and self-exploitation of migrants, so people like Kavita Dutta and Kathy McElwain. Interestingly, men and women, so I mean, masculinity features in this literature as well as, you know, female migrant experiences. I think that's important to think about it as gender, not just, oh, we need to think about gender, let's look at what female migrants are doing. There's an interesting body of work on migrant rights, not only, again, on female migrants, but a lot of it has been on the rights of domestic workers and so on. So people like Nicola Piper, for example, all of which, I mean, I find it a useful kind of shorthand to capture a lot of that work. It is what Marlon Pesce said back in 2001, but looking at the gendered geographies of power that shape migrant flows, migrant experiences, migrant remittance behavior, etc., and looking at that across scales, so, you know, intra-household scales, so the, you know, new economics of labor migration, that's all very well, looking at migration as a household strategy, but, you know, in the decision about who migrates where and what they do, you know, whether the migrant ends up being a female or a male, and whether the power in that decision making was in fact the migrants or was other, you know, male, often members of that household, I think is important in understanding both the migration, but also the remittance or broader impacts on development. Then that's probably not new to most people here. And some of the other interesting work that kind of brings together a number of these strands, I don't know if you've come across Madeline Wong's stuff on Ghanaian migrants in Toronto, but looking at the really specific nitty-gritty micro-scale remittance behavior in terms of the kind of gendered expectations and obligations on female migrants in Toronto, and them having to perform these kind of stretched kind of gender roles, including remitting money back to families at home and supporting families where they are in Toronto and doing multiple jobs in order to do that, and still feeling like they're not living up to those kind of gendered expectations. Of course, there's a male side to those kind of stories too. In terms of remittances specifically, so this is all broader than just remittances, but in terms of remittances specifically, this is an old quote now, but I'm still fairly convinced that it holds true. I haven't found much evidence to the contrary. And that a lot of that, however you want to call it, mainstream framing or dominant framing of the specific remittances and development literature is generally, and I would argue quite spectacularly, gender blind. But at the same time, it's full of all these gendered representations, gender stereotypes, or gendered assumptions about remittance behavior that don't hold true universally. Again, I mean, we can maybe get into some more detailed discussion of that, and if this was a longer talk, but I'm sure you're mostly interested in hearing about the Southern Africa stuff, and a lot of this may be familiar anyway. But I mean, my question I would throw out to you for the Q&A is why is this and why hasn't it gone away? Like, you know, who else needs to say what else in order for people working, particularly in the more kind of policy and intervention, you know, diaspora engagement stuff, to take gender seriously or just to figure out that it's important? You know, it's the gender dummy, kind of whack. So within that, I'm going to concentrate on four kind of critiques. So these are things within that broader, and I'm somewhat lumping together here some of the academic work, but this is more about the kind of policy paper-ish stuff and more about the kind of African Development Bank, World Bank, and related, but that boundary between policy and academic writing gets ever more blurry, but related kind of writing. So within those kind of constructions of remittances, I guess the mantra-esque notion of remittances, because the mantra does live on a bit in those circles. Within that, there are some, I think, identifiable gender issues. So one is the assumption often that women are more reliable remitters. So if only we could, you know, get more women to migrate because they're more reliable remitters, and then they'll send money home, and then that will lead to more development. Then there are, there's a set of kind of contradictory ideas about whether men's or women's remittances are spent more productively. So there's one kind of set of narratives that you encounter which kind of goes that, well, you know, men's remittances are important because they're breadwinners and stuff, and they send back that money. But women's remittances are kind of, you know, the kind of pin money idea. That's for the kind of optional extras. Or that men's remittances get spent on productive things like agriculture and business investment, but women's remittances get spent on, you know, that kind of education and health and kind of optional, actually, but the more kind of social stuff, not the hard development input stuff. There's a different set of narratives that comes up, which is that men's remittances, or remittances over which men have control in choosing what they get spent on, get spent on superfluous things like, you know, status symbols and fancier houses and cell phones and TVs and whatever. So that's a kind of counter-narrative. The men's remittances are more productive, but the men's remittances are less productive because they're just spent on all this kind of unnecessary, conspicuous consumption stuff. So these things kind of pop up in the literature without much explanation or kind of problematizing, I hate that word, whatever, I would think of a better word for that, but without saying, hang on a minute, this, you know, doesn't work. Everywhere, perhaps it doesn't work anywhere, and there's all kinds of gendered assumptions that go into that kind of those kind of ideas. The other thing I think that is true, and just the fact that the remittances stuff is so dominant, suggests that there's, in the kind of migration and development policy world, suggests that there's a huge emphasis on financial over social remittances, maybe because you can measure them, even though you can't measure them accurately. But social remittances tend to get downplayed in that. And then there's, people often ignore the kind of sacrifices or the costs, the social and personal and other sort of non-economic costs, as well as the economic costs, but those other costs to migration. So my work on this has mainly been conducted through my involvement since 1997 with something called SAMP, Southern African Migration Program, that was funded originally by CEDA. It's also had different funding and Canadian IDRC funding. So this is a network of Canadian and African scholars and partner institutions. When we had lots of money, more formal and established, nowadays a much more informal, kind of devolved, collaborative network of people who occasionally work together. And as part of that evolution, I've had different roles in that project, but basically I've been the SAP gender person. Jonathan Crush is the overall director of that program, and you may come across his work. He's done important work both on development generally, but also on migration within Southern Africa. So that's, you know, with due credit, but claiming all errors, inconsistencies, inaccuracies, etc., of all my own. That's the body within which I've done this research. That's where we work. Most of you, or many of you, I know, work in Africa, and most of you know Africa, but we work regionally. So people often take the urn off Southern African, and they think it's a South African migration project, but it's a Southern African migration project. Although most of what we do does end up being about South Africa, because most of the migrants go to South Africa. So even if you know you are a Southern African migration scholar, you end up doing a lot of South African work. And of course, migrants to the region come from way beyond just Southern Africa. So even in South Africa itself, they're migrants from pretty much across Africa, as well as increasingly from other parts of the world too. Interesting rising Chinese, Indian, Bangladeshi, etc. migration. I think Bangladeshi was even one of the people killed in the recent xenophobic violence. So we look at migration broadly. We also look at all kinds of migrants. So it's not just economic migrants or refugees, it's anybody who's a migrant, and those categories don't really work very well in that region anyway. So we look at regular, irregular migrants within the region, and there's a lot of cross-border migration going on, well, not only since 1994, but it's increased significantly since the end of apartheid in 1994. I'm running short of time, so this in very briefly, I do need to, I guess, sketch this, because this is the stuff you probably don't know. I've mentioned this huge increase in cross-border, intra-regional mobility for diverse purposes. So people are coming to South Africa from the rest of the region to shop, to trade, to go to school, to do business, to work, whatever. There are asylum seekers and refugees amongst those migrants. But the numbers have sort of gone from about, I think, 1 million people entering South Africa in 1990 to, so all people from all places, for all your just entrance into South African entry ports, from about 1 million in 1990 to something like 15 million by 2010. So there's lots more people coming than there were before. Immigration law, obviously, perhaps not obviously, changed with the end of apartheid, so from a whites-only immigration policy, with a few black mine workers allowed as a parallel stream, it became deracialized. But along with deracialization, it got framed in a very economic skills-based way. So it's not come one, come all from Africa, it's come one, come all, as long as you've got language skills, a job offer, and an education, which of course rules out a lot of the migrants who do want to come to South Africa. So you've got an inconsistency between the formal immigration policy and the people who want to move to South Africa. South Africa has a skills shortage, but it certainly doesn't have a labor shortage in terms of bodies. It has an official unemployment rate of about 25%. The mine labor has been a phenomenon there for well over a century. So mine laborers have been coming to South Africa for a long time. And interesting, after 94, that increased for a while, but has since dropped as South Africa's had a more South African labor preference approach to things. So there's been a loss of at least 100,000 miners' jobs from the region. And for countries like Lesotho that depended on mine labor, that's quite a spectacular job loss, a loss of source of income. So, along with the new immigration policy, there's been actually a decline in formal permanent immigration. It's tiny, but in that tiny bit, an increasing proportion, and the majority are now African immigrants. There has been a huge increase in temporary and circular migration of various forms, legalities, etc., from within the region as well as beyond. There's been, well, South Africa wasn't signatory to the UN Convention on Refugees, so before 96, I think, they signed. So before then, there were refugees, but they weren't formally acknowledged as such. They were often Mozambicans. Ironically, South Africa would cause political destabilization in countries like Mozambique, and then have to put up with the refugees from Mozambique. But there are now that South Africa has signed and does have a direct commitment to accepting refugees. It does have a dysfunctional asylum system. So at the end of 2013, there were 230,000, just over 230,000 asylum seekers awaiting a refugee determination decision. That I think is about 10 times more than the UK, even though South Africa's population is smaller, slightly smaller than the UK's population. And then, of course, an unknown number of undocumented migrants variously estimated, depending on who's trying to scare whom, of somewhere between 1 million and 10 million. So pick a number, and there are undocumented migrants in South Africa. I won't pick a number. So our work has included a number of things. So SAMP is perhaps best known for doing large regional representative surveys, one of which was a migration and remittances survey done almost 10 years ago now. So some of this data, I don't claim that it's new, this is old, if you like, but the patterns still hold. So I'll be talking a bit about that migration and remittances survey data. We've done some other things too, but the other gender-specific work that I've done and others within the SAMP network have done is on sort of more experiential migrant women's voices kind of work. So I'll be showing you things from our survey stuff, but also from my own individually conducted qualitative work with migrants and male and female migrants, but I'll show you the female migrants' voices. So quantitative and qualitative data. Numbers first, just some quick overall patterns. So these are data from our surveys. So what the MARS surveys did was they surveyed migrant sending households in the region. So the people that we or our partners spoke to were the households that send migrants to South Africa. That's important because migrant sending households are more likely to give you accurate remittance things. Because if you ask a migrant to remit money home regularly, they'll say, of course I do. I'm a very reliable remitter. But if you ask the families if they get them, that's a different question. You'll get a different answer. These are from the families receiving remittances. So sex, well, one thing that I would say from the beginning, it remains very much male migrant flows. So when people talk about the feminization of migration in South Africa, it's because it went from, well, almost zero in the official data, although there was clandestine migration, to having a small proportion of female migrants, Zimbabwe being the exception, but that's another story which I don't have time to go into here. The one thing we found is that male and female migrants, so this is again, remember, asking the receiving household about whether they receive remittances from their migrant member. Whether the migrant themselves was male or female, those are remarkably high percentages of people sending money back. So about 90% of the migrants are sending money home, and there's not, the differences by country are much more significant than the differences by gender of the migrant. There's something interesting going on in Mozambique. It's probably that they were mostly daughters rather than either female heads of household or female spouses in a nuclear or extended family household, but for the others, it's not quite universal, but very high remittance sending practices on behalf of migrants, regardless of their gender. So male and female migrants' remittances are important. So are they more reliable? Well, it depends on far more than the gender of the migrant. It depends on their sex, yes, but also their age, the household type, their position in the household. Male migrants are more likely to be older and heads of household, so it's more like, you know, it doesn't really matter that they're male or female, because female heads of household remitted the same way that male heads of household did. So comparing men and women, just as a straightforward comparison on the basis of sex, loses all that other stuff, like what is this person's position in the household, and what is their kind of gender role that goes along with that position in the household. And the other important thing was that male migrants' main occupation was mining, and female migrants were more likely to be in domestic service and informal sector occupations. So although 90% pretty much of male or female migrants sent remittances, females sent less money because they had less money to send. Even if it was a higher, in the case of women, it was a higher percentage of the earnings themselves were lower, so less money goes back. But that's another story. The other interesting finding was that, you know, our men's or women's remittances more important? Well, they get spent on the same basic needs. So remittances are the reason that people move. It is the family's livelihood, it is their source of income, it's where they get food and clothes and money to pay their children's school fees and other school expenses. So male and female migrants' remittances, and whether the recipient of the remittances was male or female, this is livelihood migration. It's not kind of luxury migration or kind of conspicuous consumption, although there might be a bit of that. It's also interesting that in terms of are they, you know, spent more productively, do male migrants' remittances get spent on those manly development things, like tractors, for example? Well, guess what? In the country, Swaziland, where remittances could be seen to be spent productively, it didn't matter whether the migrant was male or female, they were still buying those kind of agricultural input, kind of whatever, big D development kind of things. Okay, so that's those, well, sort of challenges to some of those development narratives. Shifting gears now, so the qualitative work I did on my own, when I was sitting in Cape Town writing up some of the quantitative findings from SAMP surveys, and I kept seeing, you might not be able to read them, but both in the local free newspaper that got stuffed through the letterbox, and these little handwritten things that kept being stuffed through my letterbox. Things like, you know, this one, you know, I'm a Malawian boy, age 21, I'm looking for a job as follows: garden boy, paving, painting, plastering, screening, something else, with experience, Peace Corps, whatever. And that's a cell phone number. You know, I'm looking for a job as a gardener, name James, nationality Malawian. I'm a Malawian lady looking for domestic work. You know, here people, the main, you know, thing that they often put in their small advertisement when they take one out of the local paper is that the Malawian or the Zimbabwean thing comes first. So this is in, you know, Cape Town, suburban Cape Town, people looking for work. So I thought, well, I should do something with this. I also had, the house that I was renting had a Zimbabwean woman who was the domestic worker cleaning the house and a Malawian man working in the garden. So I kind of thought, well, this is dumb not to do research while you're crunching these numbers. Talk to these people, ask who their friends are. So I spoke to each of them and actually then employed them as research assistants to do research with people that they knew, and I gave them a pile of exercise books basically in ballpoint pens, a small amount of money to pay people for the time, and asked them, tell me your migrant story and some general guidelines of things I was interested in hearing about. And I got remarkable and very rich findings. So this is the, you know, kind of book I got back. This is a Zimbabwean woman saying, I'm a 26-year-old lady. I came from Zimbabwe to South Africa some 2 months ago. I had to leave Zimbabwe because of the economic hardships I was facing whilst there. I was just in the process of enjoying my career as a teacher, but the money I was earning after a month was only equivalent to 100 rand. That's about £5, I think, yes. And I, you know, couldn't budget the money, it wasn't enough to buy basic food stuff, etc. So it's not, you know, rocket science to figure out why people would leave Zimbabwe and how important their remittances were to other members of their household left behind. One of the things that came out very strongly in these notebooks, these migrant journals, was the significance of social remittances. So I mean, I didn't ask fixed questions. This was very much, tell me your story about migration, why you're here, what you do. So these are things that just came out because people broke them down and thought they were important rather than because I'd asked specific questions about these things. But they spoke of improving their, women in particular spoke of improving their education and skills with the aim of eventually returning home, of sharing ideas with people at home about politics, including comparing South Africa with Zimbabwe. You know, Zimbabwe at the time was a complete disaster, still is a bit of a disaster, but less of a complete disaster maybe than it was. They provided information to other friends and family members about their migrant networks and, you know, possibly leading to other migrants coming to South Africa, although, again, recently probably more likely to lead to other family members deciding not to come to South Africa because of the xenophobic violence. Many of them wrote about sending love and prayers back to their family members, so it was clearly a kind of difficult experience being in South Africa. They missed family members enormously. But some female migrants expressed a kind of positive sense of empowerment about being there. But, you know, it is traumatic, I miss my children, but I'm so glad that I can provide for my family because my husband doesn't have a job and I can now be a domestic worker and send money home so that my family in Zimbabwe can survive, basically. And I mean, that, you know, Zimbabwe is a particularly intense case, but the respondents came from, I think, 13 different African countries. What also came out very strongly, so the kind of fourth point in my set of critiques of the mainstream literature, was those migrant sacrifices. So, I mean, this is common in a number of different geographical contexts. And I don't want to single out South Africa as exceptional, but almost everyone in the 30-something books that I got back had stories that resonated with these. So my employer didn't treat me very well. She shouts at me even though I didn't do anything bad. I started working at 8 o'clock in the morning and worked till 9 o'clock p.m. Somalis, in particular, seem to be the targets of violence. I hate the crime. The recurrent attacks on Somalis, I wouldn't encourage beloved ones to visit such a dangerous place. And what was also interesting and kind of gendered is the idea that these people's families themselves, although acknowledging the economic necessity of migration of a female member of the family, didn't necessarily accept that as a socially desirable phenomenon. So the women are under this kind of double or triple or whatever, quadruple bind. Men usually think cross-border women are prostitutes, but this is not so. We just work very hard each and every day. My husband used to think I had another husband here. We quarreled every now and again. This stopped when I came down with our son. We saw how I lived with other women and worked hard. So strains on personal and family relationships, also the living experiences, everyday living experiences of these migrants and the women in particular, I think, who felt very vulnerable, was not particularly desirable. So I stay in a house in Woodstock, which is not at all like your Woodstock. It's an inner city suburb of Cape Town, which has a lot of migrants living in it. I pay 80 rand per week, so whatever that is, divided by roughly 24 pounds a week. I share the room with seven other women. So not the house, the room with seven other women. And each of them also pay that much. It's not comfortable, but there is security, even though some of the women steal from others. So that was a fairly typical story from my respondents. I mean, I don't want to hear fall into the victimization trap, and I could have given another talk that was about how the gender and migration literature is just full of stuff about victimization and exploitation and trafficking, etc., that I think is important, but kind of misses some of the kind of economic side of women's migration. And there are obvious human rights abuses going on here. But in my argument, I guess, the mainstream migration development stuff would be these things that make women's lives difficult are also things that are impediments to them acting as development agents. So you don't have to come at it from a human rights perspective, you can come at it from a hard-nosed, you know, financial remittances for development perspective and argue that, you know, gender rights and human rights in migration are extremely important. So just to conclude then, I know I've gone over time, so we're going to have some time for questions and answers, and this is restating in some ways what I've said, but drawing it together. So I think that our Southern African work, both the quantitative stuff and the qualitative stuff, lends support to those feminist critiques of mainstream migration and development discourse. From our findings, male and female migrants' remittances are essential, but they're essential in terms of meeting basic human needs. We can argue about, you know, what the development aspects of that, does that count as development or not? It certainly is crucial to household livelihoods. Far more important than just whether the migrant is male or female are those things like their position in the household and the intra-household gender relations, as well as the gendering of markets and how migrants are therefore inserted into particular parts of the labour market in South Africa. It's clear there, as elsewhere, that there are significant but highly gendered personal and social costs to migration. So yes, male migrants are also exploited, abused, have appalling working conditions, etc., but I think there's an additional set of vulnerabilities that goes with being female. And again, supporting pretty much all of the critical literature on migration and development, the importance of context. So one of the interesting things that, you know, Swaziland is not like Lesotho. Neither Swaziland nor Lesotho is like Zimbabwe. You know, we're not quite sure what's going on in Mozambique with the gender stuff there. It needs to be explored some more. But each of those contexts has really interesting things and particular things about it that I think rule out any kind of simple generalization, but including on gender grounds.